I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. That Russian convicted and jailed in Russia, charged with spying for the U.S., is reportedly now in Vienna in what appears to be the first phase of a spy swap for the 10 alleged Russian spies here in this country. The Russian in Vienna, reportedly, Igor Suryakin, is a scientist. The Russian government says he also passed secrets about Russian weapons to the CIA. He has long claimed innocence, saying he merely gave public information to what he thought was a company in London. Alexei Selohubenko is the BBC World Service Europe editor. He's in London. And Alexei, Igor Suryakin worked for a think tank in Moscow. He says he's innocent. But his boss says he never disclosed that he freelanced for this British firm, which is said to be a CIA front. So that sounds pretty damning. What are he and his supporters saying?
It's a very, very murky story, and we have to remember that the whole saga started in 1998-99, at the time when Russia was badly ruled, when Mr. Yeltsin was not really in control of many things going on in that country. So what we know about Igor Suryakin, he was a very gifted scientist. He worked for the military technical department of the main Russian think tank studying America. It was the Institute of the United States and Canada of the Russian Academy of Sciences. And his story is that he was approached by a company, a firm which is based in London called Alternative Futures, which presented themselves as a kind of NGO, and they asked him for his analysis of the state of nuclear submarines, and he provided them with a dossier which he says was picked up not from classified sources but from open sources. In 1999, he was picked up by the successor to the KGB, which is the Federal Security Service of Russia. And after this, this company, Alternative Futures, dissipated in the mist. It couldn't be traced in London, which added to the suspicion that actually something was dodgy in the whole affair. And it took 5 years to actually bring him to court. He was in pretrial detention for 5 years, and only then, in 2004, he was convicted and sentenced to 15 years for espionage.
Well, let's talk about those trials. The first court that heard his case dismissed it, saying the charges were too vague. He then had a closed-door trial. The judge and jury were replaced. The lawyers, his lawyers, weren't allowed to present testimony showing that the information he was involved with wasn't secret. So his supporters say he was railroaded. Why? Why would the Russians want to do that?
Well, again, we're coming back to the power of the Russian security services, of the power of the Russian apparatus, and lack of power of the Russian judiciary. The reason why such organizations as Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International consider Mr. Suryakin to be the prisoner of conscience is exactly because the way the security services basically disregarded lots of judicial provisions that should have been observed.
Well, he'd refused to sign a confession. He finally buckled this week and did sign one. He was told his prison stay would be extended if he didn't. But I just want to ask you briefly, Alexei, about the accused spies here in the U.S. Former CIA counsel Jeffrey Smith, who negotiated a number of spy trades in the 70s and 80s, told the New York Times today that during the Cold War, spy swaps happened, but almost never before spies were convicted and did spend some time in prison. And his inference seemed to be that the charges facing the 10 spies here in the U.S. aren't, at the same level of seriousness that they once were. Your thoughts on that?
I understand that the 11, or rather the 10 in the U.S., are not actually charged of espionage.
Exactly.
The attempt is to convict them of money laundering and staying illegally, which could explain the term sleepers, that they were planted there for longer-term presence, for supplying other or maybe recruiting other agents that would really have access to real intelligence. But there are other things that are quite surprising. The avalanche of information coming from all sorts of leaks, suppositions, innuendos is absolutely massive. And I'm not sure whether actually it adds to the clarity of what's going on or whether it is camouflaging something that may be happening behind the scenes, but of which we don't know. And I think it will be very interesting if the swap goes ahead. I think it will be interesting to see whether the Russian security service will actually scrape around and find 10 agents who will be swapped for the 10 of those arrested in the U.S. I think the numbers might be much smaller.
That's Alexei Soloubenko. He's the BBC World Service Europe editor in London. Alexei, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Consumer scams have been around as long as consumers. There was that snake oil salesman, the bridge in Brooklyn. Now we have the internet and people actually send money to that Nigerian looking to move his fortune. Dave Lieber, a columnist with the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, is founder of WatchdogNation.com. That's a consumer rights movement. He's also the author of Watchdog Nation, Bite Back When Businesses and Scammers Do You Wrong. And today he's going to give us a review of the big consumer traps out there. He joins us from Fort Worth. Dave, welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
And we decided to do the story because one of our producers, who shall remain nameless, Karen, was the victim of a tooth whitening internet scam and then found out it's so widespread. She's done some research here. I have all these ads. Oh, look, there's Amy, an ordinary mom from Boston who discovered a clever trick to get a celebrity smile for less than $5. But wait a minute. Here's Emily, another ordinary mom from Boston,
Massachusetts. Amy just popped up on my screen.
Amy
just
did.
About 20 minutes ago.
Did she really?
Actually. Yeah.
And, you know, she probably pops up as coming from different cities, depending on where you are.
No, so, she's Boston.
Oh, is she?
She's Boston Amy, even here in Fort Worth, Texas.
Oh, is she? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Boston Amy is the face on one of the teeth whitening. Well, you tell me if it's a scam. What is it? How does it work?
Well, first I want to compliment Karen because
Karen, who should remain nameless.
Yeah, because see, we all get bit by these scams. You know, there's nobody immune. I don't care how smart you are. I mean, I can tell you stories about things that go on in my life that'll just make your head spin. But the thing is, she's using it to grow and show everybody else.
Right.
And this alone, this conversation we're having, should cost the money to the company, because we're saying basically that when you have a pop-up on your computer screen that tells you that you can get a white smile for a minimum of $3 and blah, 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 that is something that ensnares people now, because everybody wants to have a bright smile in dark times.
Yeah, well, and that smile, is, as you found, can cost you, $700. Tell us how it works.
Well, if you're allowed to get this free product or this $3, $4 product, and they go by 10 different names, so it's all the same company, but you can't tell because they have different toll-free numbers and different product names, and then you get this product in the mail, and you have a 10-day window to cancel, and a lot of people just don't pay attention to the fine print, don't cancel, and then they go into a hell where they can't get out, and they get billed and billed and billed because they signed this contract. But if you do cancel before the 10-day period, supposedly you're off the hook, but they make so many millions of dollars just by people that don't know
right.
how to fight back when they lose $700-$800.
Well, people who, for instance, these may be being charged to a card, but they don't, you know, see the charges come in, or and before they know it, it's mounted up hundreds of dollars. But why can't they get it back?
Well, we're in the golden age of scams right now, and it's not just the crooks anymore. It's the corporations, and these are legitimate companies that do business, and they have boards of directors. This company particularly is probably working out of London, England, by way of Des Moines, by way of Utah, by way of Colorado. All I know is when I tried to track them down, I got the biggest runaround I've gotten in years and years from any company. But there's no way the police can ever really catch them without an international cooperation and the resources and the time. So there's thousands and thousands of these scams that are going around all the time in
right.
just about every part of life, that it's easy to make a dollar this way because nobody really chases it.
Well, Karen, our producer, who we're not naming but obviously have, was lucky. She got her bank to get the money back, and they had to get it back from the company. The bank can't just reverse the credit card charges, so they did get it back. And they told her they've been fighting these charges for teeth whitening products for years. The Better Business Bureau has logged thousands of complaints.
Well, what Karen did was brilliant. I mean, she figured out the pressure points, where to squeeze. That's what I teach in WatchdogNation.com. And the next source after that, there would have been another level to go to when the bank wouldn't help you. And that would be where the company is licensed to do business in the United States. It would probably be in Utah or Colorado or wherever its home headquarters is here, and go after them there by the regulatory agencies. But only probably 5% of the people in the population can figure out how to do this, even though it's real easy and it's free. But Karen did, which is why this unnamed person, you should be so proud that you have her on your staff. She's like in a maze, and she can find her way out.
Well, we are proud. But isn't another reason why the company can get away with this, or at least fight you, is that they can point to the small print. They can say, look, right there, it said you had 10 days to return it.
Yeah, well, that's what they tell the bank, and the bank usually says, well, you signed the small print. sorry, but in Karen's case, her bank was actually really cooperative, and different banks, different policies.
And the way it's set up, it reads almost like a blog in some places, but then it's got people making comments, as you would see on any blog.
Robin, I noticed that just now when I popped up, and I scrolled down and I saw the comments, and I thought, that's absolutely brilliant, because these whitening smiles are getting slaughtered on the comment boards on the Internet, and it's just the most negative stuff you've ever seen about anybody. And then you go to their own website, and it gives you their comments, and all of them are happy. And then on the bottom, it says that when you write a comment for their website, it says the comments will appear after approval by the Consumer News Digest editorial team. So they use five words there that make you think like this is an authority of news: Consumer News Digest editorial and team. But really, all it is, it's the idiots that run this
the marketers
scam, you know, that are doing that and putting, you know, and it's a credibility builder that's designed to fool you, and don't believe it.
Well, tell us a few of the other scams that are out there that you're watching right now.
Well, one that broke my heart recently was a group of 6th, 7th, and 8th graders in the school. They had a pet pilot writing project, and the teachers and the parents and the school staff invested about $3,000 in this book, and they shipped it off to a publishing company that talked a smooth game, but when they never got anything back, and they had a book party at Barnes & Noble, but they didn't have the books, and it was real sad. And I found out about it, and I got them set up with some people in publishing, so they're going to get their book published. But I talked to the police detective in Indiana, and he went out to this guy's office, and it turned out to be this disheveled guy in a bathrobe with not too many teeth in a mobile home park. And, you know, and it's just these kids are getting hurt. So it's not only elderly that everybody talks about who get scammed, or the middle, the people in the middle like us. You know, I'm 53. You know, we get scammed in the course of business and cars and refrigerators and whatever we go through. But they're actually scamming kids now, and they're actually stealing identity theft of children's social security numbers and date of births. And so anyone from the ages of 1 to 109 is vulnerable to 1,000 kinds of things.
Well, and so this was a self-publishing scam, someone who said, you know, we'll publish it for you. If the police went out and found him, why can't they get the money back?
Because it's a civil matter between two parties that had a contract. And that's the single essence of what kills most of the prosecutions, that people get ripped off for thousands of dollars by contractors. They go to the police and the prosecutor, and the police and the prosecutor say, hey, it's a civil thing. You had a contract with them. There was no fraud here. I can't find 100 other victims. So there's power in numbers. When you get victimized by somebody or something, you always complain to the authorities, whoever it is, because hopefully there's a file already on these people. You're not the first person. You're the 20th, and you're going to be the one that's going to tip the scale where they assign a detective to go out to the mobile home park and find this guy. This detective went out of the goodness of his heart. He's in a little town of about 60,000 people. He cared enough that the kids were hurt. After I put this story in the newspaper and on WatchdogNation.com, I found out about two more other victims who both spent money on this guy, and both were writers with dreams and everything, too. That's what the Internet does. It brings all the community of victims together, and they can find each other really quickly.
That's Dave Lieber, Watchdog columnist for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. So, been scammed? Want to admit it? Just go to hearnow.org, and you can leave a comment right there. I'm sure you know, misery loves company. You might find some friends there. Later today, tar balls, skimmed oil. Where is it all going? We'll look at that in the Gulf as well. But back with more scams in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Dave Lieber, watchdog columnist for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, about consumer traps, either outright scams or legitimate businesses that suck you into supposedly free promotions, but then charge your credit card or lie and overcharge you for services like garage door repair. Sounds like a lot of the banking crisis issues we had. And apparently, Dave, you say those free credit report offers on television, you know, there's something to them as well. Let's play a little clip to remind listeners, and then, Dave, your thoughts.
They say a man should always dress for the job he wants. So why am I dressed up like a pirate in this restaurant? It's all because some hacker stole my identity. Now I'm in here every evening serving chowder and iced tea. Should have gone to free credit report.
That really strikes a nerve, because you see these commercials on TV, and you think that that's the free credit report that you know you've heard that the federal government promises that you can have one free credit report every year. And you think, well, that's my free credit report that I can get every year. So I'll just call them or go to that website. And that's not the free one. The one that the government says that you can have free every year is called annualcreditreport.com. That's the only true site, annualcreditreport.com. But if you go to these other ones that want to sell you the credit scores and the credit reports on you, and they're free, they'll charge you on your credit card for other stuff that you have to cancel, just like the teeth whitening scam. So don't go to Free Credit Report just because they have a great commercial with a great jingle.
Well, tell me, what other stuff can they charge you for?
Well, they try and hook you on an identity theft package. Then they hook you on buying your credit score, which you can't really get that easily. You have to pay extra for that, and there's two or three different kinds of scores. So the real score that the stores use, that costs money. And then they'll sell you on your annual report, even though they say it's a free report. They'll get you on some kind of charge, and they'll attach it to your credit card, and it'll be like a piece of seafood that just won't let go of your leg, you know?
Well, garage door repair scams. I did not know that there was that much call for garage door repair, but...
It's amazing. You know, I live in suburbia, and everybody here has a two-car garage door, and we're constantly banging into our garage doors. They're kind of getting bashed with our kids' baseball bats. You know, this job I have is so cool because I learned about the most ridiculous things. And what I learned in the garage door business is that there's basically one guy, and he's hiding somewhere in the southwest of America, and I can't remember his name. But he controls this set of garage door companies that are names and toll-free numbers and that start with A, so they always show up in your phone book like AAA Affordable Garage Door or AAA Affordable Garage Door. And you call this number, and they don't answer, you know, AAA Affordable Garage Door. They go, garage door, because it could be one of 30 companies that this guy owns.
Well, and someone would say, what's wrong with that? He's, you know, spreading his garage door repair across the country.
Well, it's a great question, but what they found is the guy overcharges, like, tremendously. There's a psychology to getting an older person to go in for a new garage door for $900 when they only needed a $40 part.
Yeah.
And so this guy basically doesn't have a store where you can go to, knock on the door, and go talk to the lady behind the desk. And that's what we're turning into, a country where people don't have stores. But if you find a store, a business that fixes garage door that has a place where the owner parks outside, you can go there. But if you want to try and argue with this guy hiding in the Southwest on the Internet, you'll never find him. I found him, talked to him briefly. He denied it was him. But he's like the godfather of garage doors. And nobody knows this, you know, and it kind of bothers me because it's rampant. They kicked him out of Atlanta. See, the Georgia authorities figured out what was going on, that he wasn't there, but he pretended he was on Peachtree Street and Fulton County this and, you know.
And he wasn't even there.
Yeah.
So go to your neighborhood repairman to get your garage door repaired, and chances are it isn't going to cost you $900.
No, it shouldn't. It should only cost like a couple of $100, no matter what the problem is. These garage doors are built to last, and it's a reinforcement bar that costs, you know, $50 or $80. You should also ask your neighbors. There's always one guy on every street that seems to know the answer to these. Hey, Joe, who do I get for the garage door opener? Oh, that's Hal. He's been over there for 53 years. So you go to Joe, and, you know, you give Joe brownies in return.
Yeah, well, I'm all for going locally as opposed to on the Internet. But, you know, these scams appeal for a couple reasons. In some areas, you don't have access to a garage door repairman right down the street. But also, they sell you a dream. You know, they sell you something more than just a repair. What is that, do you think, that hooks people in?
Well, these people that do this are among the most talented people in our world because they can get a person like you or me who's walking down the street, minding our business, and get us in a quick conversation with a look, a feel, an attitude, a comment, a story. They can get us to do a 180 and turn on a dime and, like, go in the other direction and help them get gas for their car or help give them $20 for a restaurant or believe that somebody in their family's dying of cancer. And also when you add the component of I have a job for you, I have a way for you to save money, I have a way for you to make money, I have a way for you to win, I have a way for you to look better with better-looking teeth, it plays on the most basic parts of human psychology that we don't even understand that go back to all of when we were prehistoric, our ancestors, and they wanted certain things and how they got them. And so the Internet just plays on. But the guy that knocks on your door is just as dangerous because, you know, I have a rule, never buy from anybody that knocks on my door. And, of course, I learned that lesson the hard way, you know, by getting burned by a few people that seemed good.
And what were they selling?
Well, what aren't they selling? I mean, I get door-to-door salesmen here in Texas that want to sell me electricity, and I get the garage door guys.
Don't you have electricity?
Yes, but it's retail, and I can switch companies. And so they confuse older people and get them to switch to a different product at a different price, and then the people are long gone, and they never see them again. Another scam that's really bad right now in the country is home burglary alarm systems, because they operate out of a couple of big companies in Utah that hire from Mormon members of the Mormon Church, and these Mormons are great door-to-door salespeople, and they take that philosophy that they learned working as a Mormon missionary in the neighborhood now to go in and doing security alarms systems that you have on your house. People are getting a hard sell, and they're buying into these contracts, and they end up with 60-month contracts, and if they move or get divorced or give up the house, they still have to pay a large monthly fee for the entire 60 months because they signed this contract that where they didn't read the small print. And this is happening everywhere, too, especially with people moving because of job loss and things like that.
Boy, that's Dave Lieber. He's watchdog columnist for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. He's also author of the book Watchdog Nation, Bite Back When Businesses and Scammers Do You Wrong. And he's founder of the consumer rights movement, WatchdogNation.com. Dave, thank you.
Thanks for having me. And again, compliments to Karen for using this experience to make the world a better place. Happy smiles.
Karen, who fell for Amy, the ordinary mom from Boston, her picture is at our website, hereandnow.org. You can go there, leave a comment about your own scam, if you dare, here and now. The focus in the Gulf has been on the oil gushing out of the well, but scientists now estimate that anywhere from 40 to possibly 70% of the eruption is made up of methane gas. Methane is the principal component of the natural gas that we use to heat homes and cook food. It's usually found in oil and it's burned off. But the impact of so much methane gushing into the ocean isn't fully understood. And one fear is that it will lead to dead zones, zones completely depleted of oxygen. John Kessler is a professor of oceanography at Texas A&M University. Dr. Kessler, you took a crew of researchers on a 10-day expedition in the Gulf. What were you looking for?
We've never seen an emission of natural gas of this magnitude to the waters of any oceanic reservoir. And we're interested in figuring out where all this methane is going and what it might do to that environment.
You say the most vigorous methane eruption in modern human history. So what are you finding out? Where is it going? What is its impact?
It seems that most of it is actually dissolving in the bottom waters of the Gulf of Mexico. We looked at this event from two different perspectives. The first one was, well, where is this methane going? If it comes out as a gas, you could simply think of it as bubbling up to the surface and being emitted to the atmosphere. And that's certainly one of the things that BP is saying over and over again, that most of this methane is just being released to the atmosphere. But gas can dissolve in water, and certainly at higher pressures and lower temperatures, like we have at the bottom of the ocean, it dissolves more readily. So we looked at it then from two perspectives. Number one, methane is a very potent greenhouse gas. So can we look at this event and learn anything about how the oceanic methane reservoir functions and potentially contributes to the greenhouse effect? But if it's not emitted to the atmosphere, if it is dissolved in the water, then it becomes a source of food for microorganisms. And those microorganisms, like you and I, when they digest their food, they consume oxygen. So if we're pumping in then all of this food to the bottom waters, is that going to lead to a feeding frenzy and a drawdown in oxygen?
Which would lead to these dead zones in which nothing could survive because there's not enough oxygen.
That's correct.
Well, a couple questions. You say, you know, BP is saying, no, it's just going up into the atmosphere. That is a potential problem, isn't it? Because, as you said, methane is a greenhouse gas.
That is true. Now, even though the rate at which oil and natural gas is coming out of the broken riser pipe is unbelievably fast, when you average out the emission of methane from this explosion, over the entire planet, it's actually insignificant. What we're interested in looking at this for is that the ocean itself is the most massive reservoir of methane on the planet. There is some evidence of prehistoric eruptions of methane from the seafloor that have contributed to climate change. What this spill does is actually replicate one of those massive eruptions, so we can study it to gain some better understanding of where this methane might have gone in the past and give us then also a better predictability on what might happen in the future.
Well, what about the near future? We're reading that as much as a million times the normal level of methane gas is found in some of the areas near the Gulf spill.
Yeah, that's exactly what we are discovering. When we look in the ocean waters, the bottom third has methane concentrations in it that we saw on average about 100,000 times above background. And in some locations, they were even approaching 1 million times above what we would normally see in the methane concentrations. And in these deeper layers where we see all of this methane, we see a noticeable depletion in the amount of dissolved oxygen. Some places it was simply as small as just a couple of percent. Other locations it was as high as about a 30% reduction. Seeing oxygen depletions of 30% is remarkable. We've never seen things like this in these locations, especially at these deep levels. So really what this screams is that more study is needed. The methane is not going to simply disperse once they stop the spill. So the question is, how is that concentration in the water going to change with time, and what is that going to do with the amount of dissolved oxygen in the long term?
That's John Kessler, professor of oceanography at Texas A&M University. John, professor, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, and up next, we're going to stay in the Gulf, but actually follow the waste from the Gulf Gusher as it travels to places like old landfills in Texas. That's in 30 seconds, here and now. With tar balls washing up on the shores of all five Gulf Coast states, what happens to the oily mess once it's scooped up off the beaches? Well, we had the beach director of Harrison County, Mississippi on the program last week. He told us cleanup crews there have picked up 1 ton of tar-coated sand, and now it's being reported that that waste is being dumped in a local landfill over objections of county officials. In fact, tar balls, oily sand, and other gunk is ending up in landfills in all the Gulf Coast states. One disposal firm, Waste Management, says it's routinely tested. It is non-hazardous. But what happens to it? And what happens to all that oily water that skimmers are sucking up? Monica Hatcher of the Houston Chronicle decided to investigate. She joined us. And Monica, first of all, that oily water waste, how much are we talking about?
It's kind of unclear. I mean, there are different types of oily water waste that are being collected. There's the oily water that's being skimmed off the Gulf surface, and the Coast Guard, the Unified Command of BP, says they've collected about 600,000 barrels of that so far, about 28 million gallons. But there's also wastewater that's being produced when they wash off things like that protective boom and other gear and the tanks of vessels that may be coursing through the oil slicks and stuff. And so how much of that is actually being collected, it's still a little bit unclear.
Well, and you found it hard to get answers to a lot of your questions. So let's start with a big one. Where is this oily, watery waste going?
It was sort of difficult to get answers to that question. I think partly it's because this is such a huge effort, and there are so many moving parts and so many different actors involved in the cleanup. But we did find out that a lot of the oily waste is being brought here to Texas, or at least 140,000 barrels of it is being brought here to Texas. Some of it is being disposed of in injection wells, which are wells that have been drilled into the ground precisely for disposal purposes. They're just sort of like, I guess, sort of underground landfills.
Mm-hmm.
They're regulated by the state. Hopefully they're adequately sealed off from, you know, the rest of the ground.
And the groundwater.
And the groundwater. Mm-hmm. Somebody with the state, Texas Commission on Environmental Control, or Quality, excuse me, told me that the wells actually are deeper than the water table, so there's no danger to, you know, area water supplies or anything like that. Other liquid waste from the drilling process that's going on out there on the relief wells is being pumped into salt domes. These are naturally occurring caverns of salt that are hopefully, you know, completely impermeable to the rest of the ground, and those facilities are also receiving some waste.
Well, how are people in Texas responding to this news that you're reporting? Last week, the EPA issued new guidelines on how BP should manage oil waste. Towns have to be told, for instance, but it's coming to Liberty County.
That's right. The sense that I got from the people that I spoke with these various state organizations was that, you know, they'd kind of been told, not really on an official basis by BP, that this material would be brought here, but they didn't really seem to have a clear idea of what it was, only that it was the landfills or the injection wells were capable of receiving this kind of waste. People want these companies, these private entities that are handling this waste from BP to be, you know, a bit more open. I know that they are private companies, but still this is like the biggest environmental cleanup in the country's history, and it just seems like some of these firms should be a little bit more open about what they're doing, who they are, what kind of facilities they're running, even if they're not really required to under law because, I mean, they're not public entities.
Well, what is one of the reasons that some of this wastewater might be coming to Texas instead of, let's say, Louisiana?
Well, well, a state official in Louisiana's Environmental Resource Department told me that some other states simply don't have the facilities that are classified to contain this sort of waste. Mm-hmm. I mean, Texas obviously is a huge oil and gas state, and we've been disposing of oil and exploration production waste for a long time, so we have the facilities here that maybe they don't have.
Well, and BP had to file a waste management plan with the EPA after the well blowout. And they listed things like not just skimmed oil, which we've been talking about, but the booms, rags, dead vegetation, dead animals, protective gear. Where is all of that going?
Well, that is going to a number of landfills in the most heavily impacted states. And according to the waste management plans, which are being administered by Waste Management based in Houston, Texas, and Heritage, which I believe is a Louisiana-based company, they've identified properly permitted landfills that are able to accept this waste safely. Oil is not considered a hazardous material, even though, I mean, obviously it's spoiling the Gulf, poisoning wildlife, but it is hopefully being disposed of properly and safely. But there are communities along the Gulf that are concerned about it, partly because maybe they don't understand what is coming, how much is coming, and how these disposal facilities are equipped to handle this type of waste safely.
Well, it's interesting you say that, at least in some sort of legal sense, oil isn't considered a hazardous material. But it is going into these special underground salt caves in Liberty County in particular. You spoke to the co-owner of one of the caves, and he says, you know, this mud that's used in the drilling and all of this waste, it goes down into these salt caves. It never comes back, he says. We put it in a salt cavern, and it stays there forever. But aren't there some people concerned that those salt caverns may not hold?
There are people who may be concerned because they simply don't know. And that's why it's very important for the companies that own these facilities to be, you know, accessible to public inquiry. You know, we're taking all of this goop out of the Gulf, tons of it, and we're putting it other places. And it's not going away. We're just moving it around. And I think people, you know, deservedly, you know, want to know where it's going and, right. and hopefully that it's being safely contained.
Well, you spoke with an environmental engineer from Valdez, Alaska, who said there is another concern in addition to, you know, people just knowing what's in landfills in their town. He said you need to know how much you spilled and then how much you picked up because the difference is what's still out there in the water. But also, he said, you can overstate how much you skim because the more you spill, the more you have to pay, you know, in penalties. But the more you clean up, the more credit you get.
That's right. Dan Lawn is an environmental engineer in Alaska, and he was one of the first people on the Exxon Valdez after it ran aground and was intimately involved in coordinating the cleanup efforts in Prince William Sound. You know, he maintained that Exxon maybe was fudging its numbers a little bit and that a company could use the justification of how much it collected to make a case that they shouldn't be liable for paying penalties on the oil that they collected.
Monica Hatcher of the Houston Chronicle. Just briefly, Monica, is there a sense that there's going to be more accounting of how much is being skimmed out of the Gulf and where it's going?
I really do think there will be. The EPA did issue that directive last week to BP asking for more transparency. As soon as we can kind of track down maybe all these companies and the Coast Guard and the BP get their act together in terms of consolidating numbers from these different companies, maybe we will have a better idea of what's being recycled out of the oil being skimmed.
Monica Hatcher, the Houston Chronicle there in Texas. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Recently, fans of the author Justin Cronin waited patiently to hear him speak at Brookline Booksmith, an independent bookseller here in Massachusetts. Justin's epic tale of post-apocalyptic vampires runs almost 800 pages, and readers are devouring it.
It took me 4 days to finish it, and I was completely addicted to it.
It's one of those books that I read it once and I very quickly turned around and decided to read it again rather than pick up the next thing in my pile.
It just kept me turning the pages. Even when I would watch TV or have commercial break, I'd pick it up and want to read another page just to keep finding out what was happening.
This adulation is somewhat new for Justin Cronin. Yes, he's a highly respected author of books like The Summer Guest and the Penn Hemingway Prize-winning novel Mary and O'Neill. But the passage has mined a vein of commercial success. There's an excerpt at hereandnow.org, but be prepared. These aren't the do-gooder, vegetarian vampires of Stephanie Meyer's Twilight series. In Cronin's world, the vampires are virals, monsters created when a government experiment to prolong life goes horribly wrong. The virals break out of the lab, kill most of the human population. The only hope for survivors, a little girl infected with the same virus but without the vampire's murderous bite. That little girl was the invention of Justin Cronin's daughter.
We have heard by now much of the story of how this book came about, that it's a story that you began writing with your 9-year-old daughter, who sounds wonderful, you know, a reader and somebody who really, you know, loves storytelling. But then we start reading the book and you have this post-apocalyptic society. Were you ever hesitant about that?
Why, because I wrote it with a child?
Yeah.
Well, first, please don't call the social workers, you know. The outline that she and I came up with basically handled the front of the story very broadly. When I actually went to write it, of course, immediately the tone of the book became what it is. So at the time, it was perfectly safe. But as soon as I started writing it, it was no longer a story for a 9-year-old. She's 13 now and she's read it. And I would say that is a reasonable floor in age.
And of course, it is a little girl that might save the world. But I guess what I'm getting at is, what do you think it says about our need to have scary stories?
You know, there's a reason we ride roller coasters. There's a reason we go to scary movies. I think they're all part of the same reason. I think post-apocalyptic or apocalyptic narratives have been around since we dropped from the trees. I think there's a very fundamental human impulse, you know, to sort of look over the edge, because when you're done, you're still here. It's a cathartic experience to read them. It's also just a sort of intrinsically exciting adventure to imagine a world with just fewer people in it. I think that's dramatically kind of attractive to readers and to people. When I was a kid reading these stories, I always saw myself as the hero of them. I never saw myself as, you always see yourself as one of the survivors.
Well, there's, you know, other popular books right now about vampires. Was that a part of it when you were talking to her? Like, was she in love with Stephanie Meyer's books or Twilight and let's get a vampire in too? Or
Stephanie Meyer's actually hadn't moved the meter yet when we had this conversation. While I was writing the book later on, yeah, that was all going on. But at its initial inception, we were really responding as much to the sort of vampire narratives of my own childhood. The experiences I had watching Dark Shadows, reading Bram Stoker, seeing the original Dracula film on Chiller Theater in the early 70s. And everybody's got their vampire years. I think it's just kind of, I mean, there's a sense that vampires right now have a kind of currency that they have never had before. That's just not true. They've always been current.
Well, but yet everybody's trying to put their finger on why they are so wildly popular now. You're saying that it's just a continuum, but do you think there is anything to post 9/11, financial collapse?
Mm-hmm. Well, the vampire narrative has a couple of really reasons that it comes back, I think, more robustly and more frequently than werewolves or other things that go bump in the night. It's a very good story with great material in it. It's got, you know, the teeth and the garlic and the mirrors, and it's got great stuff in it.
But it's sexy.
Well, it is. I mean, it's at its core, the vampire story is about sex, but in a sort of broad way. You can refashion it in a number of ways. It's actually a story about the mortal bargain of being human. We leave the immortal state of childhood, right, and become adults with all those pleasures and privileges. But at the same time, that's when we realize it's all got an end date. And at some point, we want a sort of fundamental reassurance that this is a good deal, that the richness and color and interest of our lives is in large measure because it's going to end, right? And if we were able to trade our humanity away to be immortal, something would be lost. The virals of my book are people who are trapped. They're trapped in the moment before they die. They're at this, you know, they're sort of right on the edge, and they've forgotten who they are. They have a sort of lost identity, a strong yearning to be home, to go home, which is very often what people want at the end of their lives. They also have, you know, an incredibly violent appetite, so they are to be feared.
And we won't tell you their fate, except to say The Passage is just the first of 3 books in a series. In the crowd at Brookline Booksmith is Justin Cronin's mom. Aha, maybe we can get a preview of the sequels.
I've asked him what is going to be book 2 and book 3, and he will not tell me a thing, which I think is very unfair.
I've always known what the plots of the second and the third books would be, so before I started the whole thing, I knew how it was all going to work. I actually know the last sentence of the last book, which is how I do things. I don't start writing something until I know what the last sentence is.
And the last sentence of the last book came to me in the parking lot of the Stop and Shop in Mashpee, Massachusetts, where I was vacationing with my family. And that gave me permission to write this. Yeah.
This book has been promoted really heavily online through Twitter and Facebook and book blogs. And I'm a book blogger and I follow you on Twitter and all that stuff. How do you feel about that? How is it for you? Is it fun? Do you think it works?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, they used to basically, when you wrote a book, they'd put it in a basket and shove it down the river, and maybe Pharaoh would find it. You know, like that was kind of the strategy. And things have changed a lot. What's interesting about it for me is it's something I can actually sort of track. I can see what people are saying about the book. Basically, I can overhear a conversation that before would always have gone on completely out of my earshot. Yeah.
Prior to this, you were known as a much more serious literary type writer.
And I killed 4 billion people in this book. It's serious.
But prior to that, you always had a reputation in literary circles as being a very literary novelist. Right. And in this one, it's a very literate novel, but it's with much more commercial appeal.
Right. Commercial is shorthand for it sells, and literary is shorthand for it's appreciated, right, critically. And there are indeed books that exist on a spectrum so far away from each other that they are indeed purely commercial or purely literary, right? But the middle is really broad, you know? And I realize that the books that I've always liked the most, in some ways just simply liked, enjoyed, been involved in, they tended to be books that were from the middle. And I can give you many examples. The most recent one in my life would have been Sebastian Falk's Birdsong. Does anybody know this novel? It's a war novel, ladies and gentlemen, and it's a romance, and it's, you know, it's got these great sort of sweeping themes, but it's also just magnificently written. I could not put that book down. And when somebody says, I can't put that book down, they're definitely in the presence of a story, right? A sentence isn't going to really do that no matter how pretty it is. Story will do that. And story is not plot. Story is where character and plot meet. And those are the books I realized that I loved, and that's what I wanted to do.
Author Justin Cronin speaking at the Brookline Booksmith here in Brookline, Massachusetts. The Passage is on the New York Times bestseller list. Stephen King has put it on his list of must summer reads. And the girl who helped dream it up got a pony. Justin, some peace of mind.
The best thing of all for my daughter, of course, is that she's going to get to go to college. I now have a way of paying for it, which is, of course, the great middle class anxiety, and I was able to solve that.
Again, to read an excerpt of The Passage, go to hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.